Good morning. We bid you welcome. We bid you welcome who come with weary spirit seeking rest, who come with troubles that are too much with you, who come hurt and afraid. We bid you welcome who come with hope in your heart, who come with anticipation in your step, who come proud and joyous. We bid you welcome who are seekers of a new faith, who come to probe and explore, who come to learn. We bid you welcome who enter this hall as a homecoming, who have found here room for your spirit, who find in this people a family. Wherever you are on your journey, we bid you welcome. We have announcements in the order of service that we would like for you to look at. There is what things are going on next week at UUFM. And we have a special announcement that Drew Benham will give to us at this point.
Thank you, Elke. Good morning. So we are less than 1 week away from the UUFM Visioning Workshop. On Saturday next weekend from 10 to 3, we're going to have a workshop. This is the culmination of the conversations we've been having in the small groups with the stewardship visitors, and it should be a very good event. We do have an insert in the order of service that looks like this. At the bottom of it, there's an RSVP form. If you haven't filled it out yet, we would really appreciate everybody filling out whether they're going to be there or not and which sessions you can make it for. If you have any questions about what the visioning workshop's going to be, what it would be like to come in the morning or just the afternoon or anything like that, please feel free to find me after the service. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We light the chalice now. We light this chalice as beacon of hope, sign of our quest for truth and meaning in celebration of the life we share together. Please stand as you're able to as we sing hymn number 360, Here We Are Gathered. It is now the time in our service where we are sharing significant events in our lives, be it joys or sorrows, please wait for the microphone being passed around.
Hi, Linda Krieger. I have a joy in that I just finished my doctorate at KU in nursing, and I'm really relieved it's over. Okay.
I'm Joy. My friend Megan is here.
I have a joy that it's my dad's birthday, and I have a joy that it's the Bon Voyage party.
My name's Leah Sarah, and I have a joy that there's a bouncing house because I'm a kid.
I'm Jane Pelletier, and I have a joy that there are several guests here today. Would you stand up, my friends?
I have two joys and one announcement, so I'll come to the front so people don't have to turn around. Hi, I'm Molly McGoy. Two joys about people in the fellowship. Since Christy Hazel and her family left, I have received exactly one text, and it was a picture of the state you're entering the state of Washington sign, and it said almost home. I sent back, are the animals and people going to make it? And she didn't respond. So I'm just going to assume that everything is still going well and that they are happily getting settled in Fort Lewis. Sandy Nelson is not here today because she has a big joy in her life. Lily was offered to take the ACT as a seventh grader and scored very, very high on it. And so they're actually at an honors award ceremony up in Lawrence for Lily today for kids that are part of that program. So in addition to having two daughters graduate, and they've got this going on too. The Bon Voyage party has typically been Sandy's big deal. So this is when the announcement comes in. We are going to be playing some games with the kids and things like that. Then we're going to have our potluck, and we're saving two games for the adults. One is a cookie-eating contest where you can't use your hands, so save a little room for the cookie-eating contest, please. And then also the sponge toss where you get to stand behind a cardboard box, and the kids will try to throw sponges at your head. So please be aware. You may want to do that right before leaving if you're worried about your hair or your makeup or anything, okay? So hopefully it'll be a fun day and the weather's going to hold out, and we're excited to have everybody here.
Thank you, Molly. Do we have any more joys and concerns? No? Okay. It is now for the story. Time for the story for all ages. Bryce Holbrook graciously agreed to do the story of all ages, because of the Bon Voyage, we don't have it, so it was kind of on a short notice. Thank you, Bryce. And all the children, please come on up.
I think just a chair and a mic.
Okay, guys, very exciting day. I know you can hardly keep your eyes off the castle out there in the yard, but you'll have to put up with me for just a few minutes. And this is a special day and for many reasons. School was out last week, right? Are you glad?
Yeah!
And I know you're making all kinds of plans for what you're going to do. But traditionally, we look at summer as a time to go places, right? And in many languages, the term voyage means voyage or trip or journey or something like that. And bon, of course, means good. So really the translation is have a good trip, right? So, and it's usually considered a kickoff kind of event where this is the beginning of a time when we can go many places. I remember the first thing that I did when school was out at the end of May. The first thing I did was go home and take off my shoes. And I tried not to put them back on until I went back to school in September. How many of you do that? Okay, son. It feels so good, doesn't it? You just even today I take off my shoes and just that's the biggest point of relaxation. Well, are any of you going to take a journey this summer? Well, just about everybody. Maybe if only from here to Wamego. I mean, that would be a trip, wouldn't it? Boy, what a trip. A journey of some type. So human beings are very interesting people in that they... What is it that about humans that's different? Yes?
They are more funner.
They're more funner?
Yeah.
People are more funner than animals?
Well, because it's mostly because we have more privileges than animals. Animals have less because they pretty much like hunting and getting those things. And also going with their children if they're girls. But humans, on the other side, they have children and the children have fun. The parents have fun even.
Thank you. That's really good. I'll ask you this question. How are bears and humans alike?
Well, also, bears, kind of their front paws are like hands. And also, their head is kind of like the humans. And also, they have legs, a lot of them.
Four legs.
Mm-hmm. But and also the front paws, I noticed when I saw in a picture, they have really sharp claws.
Mm-hmm. Like our nails.
Yeah. Okay. Bears
are like us is because they can walk on all fours or they can walk up on their two legs.
Okay.
Bears are like us because they care for their like cubs, like we care for our children, and it's why, and it's like that because the children are cared for, like bears care for their children too. Never leave them behind.
Okay.
Mine, we are like, we both eat fish.
Well, I'll add something to that. Humans and bears both will eat anything. They're known as omnivores. Omni means everything. A bear will eat anything, and so do we. So, Leah, did you have something else to add?
I correct William. Some people are vegetarians.
Some people are vegetarians. They won't eat everything, right? Okay, well, that's an important distinction. Well, I'll ask you this question then. Why did the bear go over the mountain? He says to get to the other side. To get food for their children. William.
Jump off the mountain.
Jump off the mountain. Well, do you know the song, The Bear Went Over the Mountain? You don't. Would you like to learn it?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I'll sing it for you once and then you can chime in. Because there's an important point here about how bears and humans are the same. And we'll come back to that. Okay, the bear went over the mountain, the bear went over the mountain, the bear went other the mountain to see what he could see, to see what he could see, to see what he could see. The bear went over the mountain, the bear went over the mountain, the bear went over the mountain to see what he could see. Okay, now what did that tell us? Yes. Okay, to go explore. It means that humans and bears are the same.
And also to let you know, some people climb hills, and the mountain is like the hill, and people climb hills, bear climb in the song, the bear climbed the mountain.
Okay, they climbed the mountain because they were curious. They wanted to know what was on the other side. And that's the same with people, isn't it? We're very curious. We climb the mountain to see what's on the other side. And so we go on these journeys. And sure, the bear went to find food. He went to find other bears and many other things. But he was curious, wasn't he? Yes.
Isn't it like the saying that one of the persons in a place where he like went, he said there was a mountain in front of him. He says, I'm just going to go over it or something like that.
Well, sure. In a sense, do people say, I just wanted to go over the mountain? Well, that's the essence of it all. It's in my way. But I just wonder, what is on the other side? And that's what journeys are all about. Well, what's the longest journey you've ever taken?
Usually in the air.
In the air. Where did you go?
Well, I went... Well, I took a fair amount of planes. It went to Kansas, all the way to Cape Cod.
All the way to Cape Cod, okay, yes?
I don't know which one's farther, from California to Florida, California to Kansas.
Okay.
My trip to going to, my road trip from California to Florida.
Thank you. A car more slower, like more faster. He's go there more longer to St. Louis.
St. Louis, okay. Maya?
I think the longest trip I ever took was going to Minnesota.
Okay.
In 4 more days, we're going to Missouri.
Missouri.
A trip to California to Kansas.
California to Kansas. Okay, I have here a very small globe, a map of the world. Our Earth, of course, we all know, is round, right? It's a sphere. It's a big orb that hangs out in an orbit around the sun. And, of course, we can locate very easily on this map where we are in the United States. It's right here. And what about if we head east and we just keep going? What is going to happen?
We're going. If you keep going around and around and around, guess what?
What?
You get to the same place where you started.
Exactly.
You're just going to go around. You're just going to keep on going around if you keep on going east. And you're just going to, like, you're just going to see a lot of stuff around that area that you're going east in.
Okay.
You go in circles.
That's right.
You go like around, around, and around. You'd be like a circle.
Well, you'll find that when you get older and older, you will travel more and more. It's possible. And I suppose, I don't believe it, but someday... people will routinely go to the moon and to Mars. We've already been to the moon, haven't we?
And also, usually, I pretty much learn on books or other magazines or something that people send rovers to Mars.
Rovers to Mars. Very true. Now, I'm an older guy, right? I'm old enough to be your grandpa, your great-grandpa, and I've had the chance to go many places. I want to show you a couple of pictures that Shirley took of me and see if you can determine where it is that I went. I'll be sure the rest of you see it up close. That's my cousin. That's my cousin Jack. He's also known as Kangaroo Jack. So where do you think I was? Australia. Yeah, that's 10,000 miles away, isn't it? Well, why do you think I wanted to see my cousin Jack? Does he look like me? Well, why not?
Because he's your cousin, and because you wanted to learn new things.
Yeah, yes.
Because you're from different, like, cultures, so he most likely has a different look to him, and plus because he's, like, you know, at a different country, and, you know, he's your cousin, and he most likely has a different family that makes him look like that.
You both, one have a beard, you don't. Mm-hmm. Your cousin have a beard, and you don't.
But he can have dark skin and a beard, but he can still be my cousin, right? Okay.
Because, well, you both are in different kind of families. For one instance, he is in a way different kind of place, and you're in a way different kind of place. So you'll probably have a different kind of culture. And by the way, to let you know that Kangaroo Jack, well, he has a lot in the difference. To let you know, he has a lot of other cultures that you might not know. Even though that person might be your cousin, you still might not know something about them. They might have something very secret to themselves that you don't even know about. And I'm telling about, and also it might not even be your cousin. You might not know everything about your children.
Oh! You get it.
Okay, thank you. We've got to wrap this up. But the point is that we are all related. We are all related. We all started the same place. His family went to Australia 40,000 years ago. And mine went to Europe 5,000 years ago, but we all started in the same place, probably in the Middle East and originating from Africa. So depending on conditions, we all look a little different, but we're not. We're all very much the same. Okay, thanks, guys. This has been great.
We are now ready for the offertory. The offertory will be given and received in grateful appreciation of our shared hopes and values. Thank you, Renee, for playing for us. A person is a puzzle. Sometimes from the inside, it feels like some pieces are missing. Perhaps one we love is no longer with us. Perhaps one talent we desire eludes us. Perhaps a moment that required grace found us clumsy. Sometimes from the inside, it feels like some pieces are missing. A person is a puzzle. We are puzzles, not only to ourselves, but to each other. A puzzle is a mystery we seek to solve, and the mystery is that we are whole even without our missing pieces. Our missing pieces are empty spaces we might long to fill, empty spaces that make us who we are. The mystery is that we are only what we are, and that what we are is enough. In the gray stillness of this morning, into the accepting peace of a still sky, let us offer our failings, our inadequacies into the silence, and let us know that we are accepted by this community exactly as we are, accepted, missing pieces and all.
Hi. My name is Linda Kreger, and I am really surprised to be standing here today, but Frau Lorenz taught my two boys German, and my older son, I remember saying to him, if Frau Lorenz asks you to do something, you have to do what she says. And so, when she asked me to do this, I said, okay, I'm going to talk about my spiritual journey. I'll talk about my parents and my upbringing and then what led me here to the UU, but I'll start by talking about my parents. Both of my parents are German immigrants, and they grew up during World War II in Germany. My father lost four of his brothers on different fronts and a sister who contracted tuberculosis as a nurse for the Red Cross. So his family was half gone by the time the war was over. My mother's family was younger, but they both told stories of being in bunkers or hiding in the potato cellar when the bombs came, and they prayed and prayed and prayed. So after, and they grew up in a very small Catholic town. They moved to the United States in the mid-50s and eventually ended up in about a very small Catholic town in Iowa, Dyersville, Iowa, which is Field of Dreams, Iowa. Some people know it by that. It's also the home of St. Francis Xavier Basilica, which is a huge Catholic church and a huge Catholic community. So I grew up going to Catholic schools from kindergarten through all of high school. But I remember even then thinking I'd see the nuns in grade school pile into their station wagon that was beat up and hardly ran. And then I'd see the priest in his big, long, you know, Plymouth, whatever. And it just didn't seem fair. And so little things like that creep into your thoughts as you get older. When I was, after my senior year, that summer before college, I spent the summer volunteering at the state mental institution in Des Moines, living with two nuns and three other young women who were all thinking about the convent. You know, my dad always thought, three sisters, my dad always thought one of us should be given back to the church, and I think I was the one that was supposed to be given back. So I spent my summer at that camp, and it was a good experience, but I then went to University of Iowa, and once I got there, I knew I was not going to be a nun. It's a very liberal college, a very great campus, and I was still a practicing Catholic because that was the faith of my fathers and our family, but I started disagreeing with things like birth control, women's health issues, the male power structure of the church, but all of that I just kind of forgave as things went along because that was my religion. I met my husband there, and he happens to be Jewish, and neither parents were thrilled with this match. So, I mean, they supported us now once I had kids, but initially both of them said to us, marriage is just not going to succeed. And I remember saying to my dad, I can marry a Jew much easier than I could marry a Republican. And that kind of kept him quiet. And we've been married for 26 years, and both parents now are very supportive. So I was a practicing Catholic, kind of forgiving the things that I didn't like about the Catholic Church, as I think a lot of Catholics do. But then my younger son, when he was a senior in high school, told us about his sexuality. And this is going to be the hard part, but that was a real surprise to us because, you live with this kid and you don't know that they're gay. And he talked about nights in his room thinking about killing himself. and packing a bag. Excuse me, just for a second. Packing a bag to leave because he thought we would kick him out. And I thought, geez, he doesn't know us and I don't know him. But anyway, I had that chance then to get him ready for college, but I felt so guilty about all those years that I couldn't help him. You know, he was 13, 14, 15, and crying in his room, and I didn't know it. And I felt guilty that Mike and I had passed something on to him genetically that was going to make him make his life much harder. And I became very sensitive to, you know, just the jokes and things people say that when they don't know that your child is a homosexual. So I felt guilty about that. I felt guilty about not being able to support him. I felt guilty about trying to get him to go to proms and homecomings. I felt guilty about having him go through the Catholic education and confirmation, all the while he knew he was gay. And then this church was not going to accept him. So there was just no end to the guilt, and there still isn't any end to the guilt. So I kind of dropped out of the Catholic Church. I tried to go. I just couldn't do it anymore. It felt like I was going through a really bad divorce. And it took a year, at least a year, before I even felt like myself again. And then my husband kind of, he never got why I went to church. He never understood why I needed that community. But he was the one who actually got me to come out here because he found out that my friend Melissa came out here and said, why don't you just go with Melissa once? And that was really a good thing for me because I have felt most welcome here. I've been able to talk to people here like I couldn't. And I have this sense of community again now, and I'm really grateful for that. So I think my faith journey probably is just starting. You know, I've been through one kind of journey, and now I'm definitely on another kind of journey. And I'm feeling better, and my son's doing fine, so thank you.
Well, another Catholic story. We're everywhere. I once had a friend who was a runner. He told me that as he ran, he imagined he was carrying an unzipped backpack on his back. During his run, all the negative images from his life, all the hurts and self-doubts, fell out of the backpack along the way, and he ended his run in a much better place than he was in when he began. You know who that was? It was Brad. I think that my spiritual journey in recent years has been something like that. I'm sorry. I was so touched by the last one. I haven't recovered yet. Except that in addition to moving forward and dispensing with some things, I am also walking back over the path I have traversed, and I am picking up gems that might have been discarded too hastily. I am re-embracing them in their essence and regarding them as cherished gifts. I was born and raised just south of Boston, Massachusetts. My cultural influence, which has strongly influenced my life, was shaped by my family and the community in which I lived, Boston, Irish, Catholic, and Democrat. My 12 years of formative schooling were all in Catholic schools, and they provided me with what all children need, an excellent basic education and a sense of safety and security. God's in his heaven, all's right with the world, to quote Robert Browning. Having been steeped in Catholic social justice teaching and having fallen in love with Jesus when I was a teenager, I manifested these two essentials of my lifelong identity by entering a Franciscan religious community right after high school. I served as a teaching sister for 11 years. During that time, I also furthered my education by completing my bachelor's work in a Catholic college and by becoming steeped in Franciscan spirituality. I also had a chance to do my master's work in the education of children with behavioral disorders so that I might work with marginalized children in the education system. Another manifestation of my Catholic heritage of social justice and living out of the inherent values of my spiritual journey, love of God and service of others. I left religious life in 1967. 10 months later, I met and married my dear husband, Paul. Our 37 years of marriage were a blessing, and I have to say, a time of mutual spiritual growth as we lived out the challenges and gifts of raising children together. Our marriage was blessed with two wonderful daughters, Nanette, who is married and lives with her husband, Steve, and two children in Overland Park, and Laura Bonella. As you know, Laura, her husband, Mike, and their daughter, Kaya, are members of our fellowship. Which brings me to the start of the run that I described at the beginning of this presentation. In the early 1990s, Laura knocked me off my feet by declaring that she was no longer a Catholic and, in fact, no longer Christian. At first, I thought that I had failed in the most important task of my parenting, that of giving my daughter a strong faith that would carry her through life, assured that she was loved by a benevolent God who would embrace her forever. How can I, Laura asked, belong to a church that denies me the sacrament of ordination solely on the basis of the fact that I am a woman? I had to agree with her, and I had to ask myself, if my brilliant and beautiful daughter has to leave the church over this issue, perhaps both the church and I have defined too small a God. The race was on. I set out to learn a bigger God, feminine images for God, images from nature, and from mystical traditions. Along the way, I learned that all of these are, in fact, part of my own tradition. Because those who had voiced the tradition over the years and who had developed formulas and rituals were all male and were educated and lived in closed male societies, the feminine voice was missing. Images that appealed to male sensibilities had been selected to refer to the divine, and structures that supported male authority were given divine approbation, as it were. Oh my, there was liberation in realizing it was all there and only needed looking for, like a treasure in an archaeological dig. So I became familiar with authors and speakers, both women and men, who could guide me along broader highways and byways and lead me to expanded insights. I looked for spiritual guides and soul friends who could figuratively hold my hand through the dark nights of uncertainty and doubt. My path has been precipitous in the past 20 years. In fact, as I told a friend in a recent conversation, I'm changing so fast I can't keep up with myself. I have had magnificent guides for my path. One has been life itself. For 5 years, I walked with my husband, Paul, toward the moment of his passing into new life. In the Catholic tradition, we use the term sacramental, that is, those things that speak to us of God or reveal God to us. The gifts that Paul and I gave to one another in that time were definitely of God, who is love, manifested in every breath, every act of caring, every bit of laughter. It was a sacred time. Paul died in 2005. In 2007, my first two darling grandchildren, of course they're darling, were born, and another came along in 2010. I have seen new life and have a new understanding of resurrection as I see resemblances to their grandfather in each of the children. I believe what one spiritual teacher says, God comes disguised as your life. Another guide that I have had is my immersion in centering prayer. This form of meditation or contemplation has been my primary prayer practice for about 20 years. In this practice, one moves from the head into the heart, and there one can encounter, without images or words, the indefinable holy mystery. I have learned that although God cannot be known with the logical mind, God can be experienced, loved, embraced, and surrendered to by the mystical mind, the mystical heart. I'm going to be touched. I have been so fortunate. Excuse me. To have connected for a number of years with a cadre of women friends, excuse me, they touch me, with whom I meet for book studies and discussion, we'd probably define ourselves as progressive Christian feminists, and we keep each other sane amidst the foibles and foolishness of the institutional Catholic Church and the hierarchy. We know that they are not the church, but only a small, limited, functionary minority voice. Unfortunately, they get the microphones and the press coverage. Other voices, especially feminist scholars, liberation theologians, contextual theologians, and current scripture scholars, are the ones my friends and I read. And they are the ones whose ideas support our journeys into experiencing and loving a bigger God. Mike Bonella said to me recently, "I never heard any of this stuff, even when I went to Catholic school." And I responded, "That's because you're no longer part of the conversation, Mike." But I have been lucky enough to be part of the conversation with wonderful contemporary writers and speakers, and with friends both here in Manhattan and through the internet. I have national and international friends and contacts who support my journey as I do theirs. In addition, I make regular retreats, often at Manor House of Prayer in Concordia, Kansas. Anybody is welcome to go with me at any time. My spiritual path has led me to reevaluate how the goodness and holiness of my reevaluate the goodness and holiness of my tradition, not to throw it away. What is the essence of the scriptural message, couched as it is in the language and, importantly, the philosophies and cosmology of the people who lived from 1000 BCE to approximately 100 of the Common Era? Why did the early Christian community use the words they did to encapsulate their experience of Jesus? And of course, how could creedal formulas written in the 4th century be presumed in their dated language to convey the understanding of the holy mystery that we have grown into today? I remind myself that when I visited England, I heard a woman say, "I'm going to make apple crisp for the pudding." What? Crisp and pudding in one sentence? I didn't know at the time that pudding was the English word for any dessert. This was a confusion about a contemporary word in the same language that I speak. I can only imagine what we don't know about words chosen by the authors of the scriptures who wrote in ancient languages, which have been translated many, many times over 2,000 to 3,000 years. So I have learned that words are conundrums. Words hide as much as they reveal. Most importantly, I have learned that all religious language must be understood as metaphor or analogy. I have come to experience the divine mystery, not as that which is unknowable, but that which is endlessly knowable. This is, however, the knowledge which comes from intimacy with the beloved, not merely from the exercise of one's intellect. I live in the peace that comes from realizing that the holy mystery of the divine is not a puzzle to be solved, but rather a fountain fullness of goodness and love, which can be endlessly enjoyed, endlessly relished. St. Francis of Assisi even called God delectable. So now I am more able to embrace paradox. I can both cherish the deep spiritual and contemplative contributions of my Christian tradition and see the good in the perennial tradition common to all paths. I can be both Catholic and Unitarian Universalist at the same time and not be in conflict with myself. I love being in relationship with a divinity who is not, as one of my friends says, an off-planet God. I love knowing the holy mystery that resides within me, within all others, and with all of creation as well, the one, as St. Paul says, in whom we live and move and have our being, the one whose being we share. I love knowing that the Beloved is with me in death or life, joy or sorrow. The Compassionate One walks with me, breathes with me, suffers with me, rejoices and laughs with me, and is closer to me than I am to myself. I'll stop here, but let me conclude by sharing with you my current daily prayer. Dear God, I hope I won't die yet. I haven't stopped relearning. Amen.
Good morning. My name is Mary Peterson. I don't know most of you, but I know a few of you, and I hope to know more of you. I'm so glad that people came this morning. I was afraid that when my name was on the program, nobody would be here. I was given the charge of telling about my spiritual journey. I'm not sure that I have a journey, let alone a spiritual journey, but I'm working on something like that. I'm close to 80 years old, and so I better find it pretty soon, because I'm going to be in real trouble if I don't. I thought this morning that I would tell a couple of stories. That's what I do the best. I'm not great at chronology, so you'll have to fill that in for yourselves. I talked with my daughter, Michelle Jeanette. Some of you know her. And I said, this is what I was thinking of saying. And she said, oh, mother. She said, cut it in half or more. And she said, be careful of the data, and for heaven's sake, don't preach. She said, you always do your very best when you avoid the preaching, so I'm going to try to avoid that. And if I do, please don't tell her. I'll be in an awful lot of trouble. I'm sure that you've heard the saying many times that everyone makes mistakes, and I'm going to talk about some mistakes today. I'm going to talk about how difficult it is for me to have made those mistakes turn into stepping stones instead of boulders that I had to crawl around or walk around. The first story that I'm going to tell is not really my story. It's really my daughter, not Michelle, but Lisa. And this is a story that she has instructed me to tell as often as I get a chance to give a speech. I haven't given a speech for 10 years, so pray for me. You know, we're going to have some problems getting through this. The story is an old story, one that I'm sure you've heard before, and you've heard allusions to it today. It's about what happened to her when she was 6 years old. When she was 6 years old, she was sexually molested by a boy in our neighborhood, a teenage boy, who was our babysitter and our friend. And I'd like to tell you that, you know, this was an easy thing for us to handle. It was not. We spent quite a bit of time really trying to discern, you know, what was really going on and what was the problem and why this had all happened. And we were not very successful. There was a lot of accusation in the house. There was a lot of blame in the house. There was a lot of frustration and anger in the house at everybody, not just the boy. But finally, we managed to pull ourselves together, and we got involved with some very good therapists. And we spent a long time with therapy. We spent a long, long time reading books. We spent a long time going to various kinds of healing mechanisms, various places that would help us understand, you know, how this had happened. But we eventually got to a place where we were somewhat stabilized. At least I felt we were somewhat stabilized. And I thought that we were, you know, going to get through this. Well, one day, but you know, of course, that never happens. And one day, when it was a beautiful spring day, my daughter Lisa and I were sitting in the backyard and talking about life, which we often did, and what life meant. She was now 11 years old, and if you know about pre-puberty, you know this is the time when children begin to, you know, ask questions. This is the time when children begin to come into their own, and they begin to sometimes question their parents. And so we'd had a lot of experiences talking about, you know, what this all meant. And my savvy little girl said, "You know, Mother, every time we sit down and talk and we ask ourselves questions and we say things to each other that are very, very meaningful, it occurs to me that you never bring up my experience. You never bring up my past. You never bring up this topic. You wait until I mention it. And then you talk. But you never start the talk. And I want to know why it is that you never really act as though you're interested in what happened to me and why it happened and why you don't talk to me more about it." Well, I had excuses. Believe me, I had excuses. I knew all kinds of reasons that I wasn't going to bring this up. And I said things like, "Well, I always thought, darling, that it was your story to tell, not mine. I always wanted to play second fiddle, not primary fiddle. I always wanted to wait until you set the stage and you said things." And I had a lot more excuses that sounded just like that. And she said, "Mother, you are so full of baloney." She said, "I know that's not the truth. I know you. I know that you would speak up. You would say things if you really wanted to. I know that you know that many, many girls have gone through experiences that are something like this. My daughter was not raped, but she was molested, and it was painful, and it was horrible, and it lasted for several months. And I didn't have the courage to bring this up and talk to her about it in an open way." She said, "It's really time that you let me know what you really feel." She said, "I'll tell you what I think you feel. I think you feel ashamed. I think you're embarrassed. I think you don't want to talk about this in an open way because you think you've got the lid on it and it's sitting on the stove with a tight lid and you don't realize it's still boiling inside." She said, "I think that we really need to be more open about this." She said, "I know that you talk about how girls are treated. I know that you give sexual harassment courses. I know that you have been a civil rights compliance officer for Title IX. I know that you know the ropes on this. I know that you know the numbers. You know how many girls go through this before they're 18 years old. The number is very, very high." She said, "I know you know these things. And I want you to get up and I want you to talk about this in a speech. And I want you to talk about this every time you get a chance. And I want you to tell people that people live through this and they become normal and they know how to handle life and they have talents and they have skills and they are not just this event." She said that healing takes place in a family. Healing doesn't take place in a therapy room. Healing takes place everywhere. The whole world is really there to help us, but we have to let them know. So from now on, I want to hear you talk about this. I want to hear you tell people the truth. I want to hear you say the things that need to be said to the world about a family that goes through something like this and manages to come out on the other side with understanding, with skill, and with a compassionate heart." Well, gulp. I listened to everything she said, and even though I didn't believe the whole story, I didn't believe everything she was saying. I knew that she was developing into an adult who could handle her life. I knew that she was developing skills that she would be able to use the rest of her life. I knew that she was now on the other side of the fence. I knew that she was going to get ready to be an adult and be a real person. My daughter is now married with 4 children. She is a lawyer, does litigation every day, gets up and on her feet and speaks for people who need help. She makes a lot of money. She's very powerful in her community, and she always speaks her mind. I'm so very proud of her, and I really feel as though I shortchanged her for several years by not letting her know that I was really, truly on her side, and I was willing to do what she thought I should do, not what I thought I should do. The second story that I have to tell you is a little bit different, but it has the same message. And my message, in case you haven't figured it out, is we should be prepared for life, no matter what it happens to us, no matter how it comes down. We should have as many toolkits, as many things, many arrows in our toolkit as we can possibly have. And we should be able to rock with whatever comes along. This particular story had been about my family and how, excuse me, there's a fly up here, and how things had worked in that situation. My next story is about the world, about the community. When I was in junior high school, I had a social studies teacher who taught us a game. These are poker chips. And he called the game the power game. The gist of the game is something that's pretty common. I'm sure many of you have played this game. I used it many times when I was doing training and did various kinds of activities with people. It's a great game, and it has a lot of possibilities and a lot of potentials. It's played with poker chips, and the poker chips have different colors, and the different colors have different point values. Red could have 10 point values, blue could have 20, yellow could have 30, and white could have 50 points. And if you have a class or a group, you divide the group or the class up into sections. I guess, are you talking to me or raising your hand? Okay. And these sections, you give them instructions, and you say, we're going to trade chips. We're going to trade barter. We're going to do what we can to be able to increase your holding. And so you want to increase your holding based on which color chips you trade for. If you don't trade, you will be penalized, and you will lose points whether you trade or not. So you need to trade if you want to make points. And so it's going to be done in sessions, and where each session is 5 minutes long. So you sit down in the various groups. I have 3 groups here, and they are going to trade. They're going to trade and see how many points they can get in their particular group. So everyone sits down, and of course they're very cautious and very suspicious in the beginning because they don't want to lose any points, and they know that the other people in the other groups are going to do whatever they can to talk them out of the high-pointed chips. So they wait, and they push, and they play back and forth. And at the end of 5 minutes, you call time, and you have people count and total up their chips. And nearly always, one team is ahead. Not always, but usually one team will have won more points than the other people. And they do it by hook or by crook or whatever. And so then the rules change. And as the moderator or the teacher or the leader, you no longer make the rules. The rules are now made by the team that made the most points. Well, what do you think happens? The team that makes the most points makes very punitive rules for all the other people, right? You know, let's not be kidding about this. We know perfectly well that's what they're going to do. So you do the same thing again, and at the end of the next 5 minutes, you count the points. And usually, the team that had the most points the first time also has the most points the second time. And if you do this for about 4 or 5 times, what do you think happens? War. You know, people are angry. They feel that they've been cheated. They've been cheated by the leader. They've been cheated by smart aleck people in the various groups. They've been, you know, a lot of things have happened in them. And so they talk about how, you know, they don't want to play this game anymore and what they're going to do. And they're very angry. And that's when the best part comes, because now you get a chance to talk about the unfairness of life, the part luck plays in how things work out, the part that cheating plays in how things work out. You get to talk about all of these issues. And as a person who was doing civil rights training, it was wonderful for me because I got to talk about how intervention, like civil rights laws, makes it so people can't always cheat, can't always push ahead, and that greed sometimes needs to be curtailed and stopped. Well, one day when I was playing this game, I got a real surprise. And after the second round, one of the groups said, "I'm not playing this game anymore. I'm not doing anything that you want me to do. What I'm going to do is give away all of my chips to the other three groups." And I said, "What made you think that?" And they said, "Well, you know, life has a lot of unfairnesses in it, and I'm not going to participate in those. Life has a lot of people who take advantage of other people, and I'm not going to participate in that." And this was a real eye-opener to me, because I, of course, know about people who've been like this. You know, Martin Luther King, Jesus, Gandhi. There are people, you know, who really have bucked the system and said, "I'm not going to participate in these things." But it had never happened to me in the real world. It had never happened to me on my turf, in my venue. It had never happened. So I was really impressed with this person, and I was impressed with why he would decide to go ahead and buck the system. But it taught me a lesson. It taught me a lesson about how to deal with the world and the world's problems, and that sometimes it's really important to stand up and say, "This is not right. This needs to be changed. This is not the way we were meant to be." And I got involved in civil rights marches. I got involved in writing letters. I got involved in giving speeches. I got involved in talking to unpopular groups about how they could be more effective. So I did all of those kinds of things. And that was a really good experience for me, you know, coming from a small town in Arizona where, you know, life was pretty conventional and very few things happened like this. So it was a very growing thing for me, and it really helped me to become involved as a world citizen, not just a family citizen. And these two adventures for me really did influence my thinking and how I was going to live my life and what I should do. Now, this is the time in my speech that I should usually start to preach. But rather than do that, I'm going to play a tape for you. And this is one of Woody Guthrie's songs. I know you all love Woody Guthrie because I've been here enough to have heard his stuff played quite a bit. But this song is one that you may not have heard, and it's called "Keep My Skillet Good and Greasy." And I always thought that was a metaphor for life, you know, that you should be prepared. You know, whatever is coming into the kitchen, you should be ready with a good greasy skillet. And so I'm going to play that for you. I don't know how much time I have, but I think that you'll enjoy it. And that really is the sermon part of my talk. And I do want you to know that I do appreciate this congregation. I wish I knew all of you better than I do. And I really do appreciate being able to come here. And thank you so much for having me speak.
Thank you very much, Linda, Jane, and Mary. It was a very special service for us today. We are now going to sing our closing hymn, "Grieve Not Your Heart." Renee will play it one time through before we start singing it, and Dick Beeman will help us as well. So we just stand when we are ready to sing, which we are not. May the peace of this community preserve our going out and coming in from this time forth until we meet again. Go in peace. And join us for our potluck.